I'd like to welcome you to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Don Bishop. I write as T.S. Pedramon. And I'm super awkward. I'm here today with Thomas K. Carpenter. And we met at the 20 Books Vegas conference. Just on the last day.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were going out to your car. Mm-hmm. Why don't you introduce us and introduce yourself and tell us a little about yourself?
Yeah. Thank you. And happy to be here. Again, my name is Thomas K. Carpenter. I have over 60 books published, a number of genres, but mostly for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been writing in urban fantasy, Magical Academy, with my big universe of books being The Hundred Halls, which is about a modern magical academy where each hall teaches a different kind of magic. And I write a series around each one of these halls, a 5-book series. For instance, I have one about book magic, word magic, another one around assassins, another one around animals, stone singers. So far, I've got 31 books out in the universe and, working on more every day.
Wow. It sounds like when you mentioned in your emails, or maybe when I think it was in your emails, yeah. I looked at your website, so I don't remember which, but I think it was your emails. I had a thought, like, it sounds maybe a tad Cosmere-ish, and I'm not, there's nothing to bash there.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have the 100 halls in each one, like you write each thing and it has a different kind of magic. I think that's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, I think Cosmere's probably, Sanderson Cosmere's probably one of the more well-known universes. I think one difference is his are all very different time periods. The Wax and Wayne series is kind of almost a Western feel with magic. Mistborn happens, like 1,000 years before that. And I haven't read, I've read a few of the series, so I kind of see how it fits together. One difference is mine is all within, the relatively short time period, from book. The first book that it's introduced to now is maybe like a 10-year period, so I'm going wide across a similar time frame where he's, scattered amongst a long history and almost very different feel to the worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's interesting. I have a universe that so I don't have any published books yet. And in fact, the universe I'm about to talk about, it won't be my first book published, cause I care about it too much. I put it on a shelf while I'm writing something else. Cause I'm transitioning off of the, off of Marine Corps active duty.
Right.
And actually, so today, as we record this, it's November 29th. My end of active service is 2 days away.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. When this episode goes out, I'll already be off of active duty. I am switching into the reserves, so I'll still be I'll still wear the uniform part time. Right. When this goes out, I'll be a full time author without any books published yet. I have the thing that I'm pushing out to market first is Nightshade Unicorn, but I have the Grand Hill Chronicles. Yeah. That I've named my podcast after, is a universe with many worlds. And I actually had the idea for it before I ever heard of Brandon Sanderson or any of his books. I started that book in 2010 under NaNoWriMo.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually came out of a dream, literally. I had a dream where I was the person carrying this king's baby's weapons from one world to another world where they would be hidden for a time. And so when I woke up, like, they're okay. So royalty, babies are born with weapons. Okay. And there's traveling between worlds. You know, so from the foundation, I have multiple worlds. I'm not going to have the world so separated as Sanderson does.
Right.
You know, like, you read the Stormlight Archive and almost everything is there on that world. And in the first book, everything is there on that world. You know, it's not until later that you go through Shadesmar and switch. And there's some Shadesmar in the first. Oh, dear, I have a notification. I hope the software silenced that. So yeah, just different, I guess, different ways. I don't plan on having different magic systems in that universe, though. I will have different cultures.
Yeah.
And they might tap into different resources. But I'm actually envisioning where this universe branched out from a single civilization. And so all these different cultures will have a common root as far as the magic system goes. No, I'm sorry. This is supposed to be about you. So, I do talk too much. So, I'm looking at my notes here, and we met, you're right, you were on your way out to your car at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. We were loading up after the, signing event.
And you're in mountain time. I think you said Denver, right? You were going to Denver?
Colorado, or we're at Buena Vista, about 2.5 hours southwest of Denver, maybe an hour and a half west of Colorado Springs. So,
okay.
At 8,000 feet. So, you know, we get some snow and some fun cold weather.
Yeah. Yeah. I've driven through those mountains. I don't know your town, so I can't say that I've been there, but I've driven from Utah to Southwest Kansas. So I took the 40, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I've been through those mountains on my 40.
Yeah. It's a lot of pretty driving through there.
Yeah, it is.
Except for the Kansas part.
Now, we did select a conversation topic for today. We're not beholden to stick to it. I mean, this podcast goes far afield, and that's fine. Whatever is interesting, we want to go there. So while before we settle on a topic, I suggested maybe we could talk about how you've converted your fantasy series into a card game. That might be something to talk about along the way. The differences between writing epic fantasy versus urban fantasy, because looking at your website, I saw kind of both of those. Building magic systems, your experience or method. And I am hoping to get C.R. Rowenson on this podcast as well. I talked to him at 20 Books. I haven't emailed him yet just because I've been really swamped, and he's kind of a big name, so I want to nail that email in order to get him on. But he wrote a book about writing magic systems.
Right, right.
But I am curious about your experience, because you've created several different magic systems. Now, in the end, you suggested, I don't have it on screen in front of me, the
challenges of a big
pleasure and pain. The challenges and
benefits, yeah, the big series, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we can, happy to talk about all those to wherever you want to start, yeah.
Yeah, I do want to make sure that the listeners, all two of them, get a good chance to know you. So, like, what's your background, education, profession?
Yeah, I went to college and got my engineering degree, metallurgical engineering, in what's now Missouri Science and Technology. I had every intention of writing, but I knew at the time that writing is not something you just, oh, I do and then become, you know, successful. I knew I was going to have a career for a while. You know, I worked basically for the almost entirety, 25 years of my career for Toyota in one of the casting plants outside of St. Louis. And while that was great, you know, provided a lot during that time, you know, I was writing the whole time. And really when indie publishing started in, you know, 2008, 2009, I realized that was a great way to go, because of the nature of why, you know, I write a lot and traditional publishing tends to be more, you know, they want a slower pace. So, you know, immediately gravitated to that, you know, started putting out novels, you know, some, alternate history, some science fiction, YA dystopia. But eventually gravitated to urban fantasy, that, you know, this Magical Academy series. And, as it's been 2.5 years now, I finally got to the point with the career that I was able to, you know, say goodbye to the corporate world and move on to writing full time. And that was when we, you know, if you can, you're not tied down to a specific location and you can live anywhere, you know, we chose to live out here in the mountains where we like to do a lot of hiking and skiing and whitewater rafting and stuff like that.
Okay. So I have a question that I hope both of both of my listeners, I joke, it's more than two. It's not a huge number, but it's more than two.
Gotta start somewhere.
I hope they're interested as well. Because it's so you worked for Toyota, you got a degree in metallurgical engineering. Is that what you
yes,
said?
Yes. Yeah.
And you worked for Toyota, which makes me wonder, like how much of the engineering that foreign manufacturers do, how much of that is done, stateside? Cause I kind of understood that they basically do all their designing in their home offices in Japan or whatever. And then over here, you're kind of more coordinating. Like obviously they have to have a marketing hub here. Somebody has to know this market. So yeah, what's that relationship between their Japan offices versus
domestic? You know, I'll put my old Toyota hat on. You know, I think, for as far as like Toyota cars in the US, probably, I don't remember what the percentage is, but, you know, 75% of the parts come from here in the US. In the very beginning, when I first started working for Toyota, it was just a you know, plants were being started in various areas, Kentucky, West Virginia, Indiana, things like that, you know, in St. Louis. And then, you know, at that point we were just taking, you know, they would send us the equipment. We would go over there, learn how to do everything. And then we would, you know, build out the products over here and the cars. But over time, you know, as things built up, the US side started taking over more and more responsibilities because cars built in Japan are going to need to be different from the US, and people over here understood the needs better, for what that entailed. So, you know, there's always going to be a core of it that's done in Japan, but certainly some of that is also done in the US now, as well. So
were you involved in like making sure that the materials acquired were up to spec for what they designed in Japan? Or, I guess, cause you mentioned the different needs of different cars. Is that because we have, they probably have more city driving than most Americans over here? We have,
most
of the country has less rain than Japan. So maybe,
I think like, you know, the roads are narrower in Japan. People don't go as far distances. Like a really simple thing is, a soda cup that you get at McDonald's has got an enormous base on it. And so you need a cup holder that is big enough to hold that, you know, the, 7-Eleven jug of Mountain Dew that you need to drive 14 hours across the country. And so, you know, in Japan, they don't need that. You know, a lot of times it's a much smaller cup holder. So little things like that. And then as far as, you know, in working for them, a lot of that, we would feed back things as we would, you know, we would get involved with the, you know, the designs and things like that. And we would feed back things that might be different for us, because not every material you're going to use is going to be the same. An example was, you know, they didn't design things with water cooling in them to deal with our mineral heavy water. A lot of times they use desalinated or, you know, water from the ocean or things like that. So it was extremely clear, extremely clean, and didn't have a lot of excess materials. In Missouri, we had a lot of minerals in the water. And so those were things that we had to deal with that they, you know, was unique to our manufacturing side of it. So
yeah, okay, that's interesting. So as far as, do you write full time now?
Yes.
Did you make that full switch? I would imagine with 6 books out.
Yeah.
And so you said that you always wanted to write, but at the time you realized that you couldn't count on that as a career.
Right. I would say I was always writing. Like in college, I started working on my first novel, and, you know, shopped that around, you know, made lots, you know, I've been doing it a long time. You make lots of mistakes. I like to think I've made most of the mistakes you can make in this industry, but I, you know, kind of keep persevering and keep going. But yeah, those, you know, that early years, there wasn't a lot of information. You didn't have the internet. You could look up how to do things, where to send things. So it was very confusing. You know, you had this really thick tome that, you know, didn't explain anything. It was just, here's all the agents out there. And you just look through it and tried to find some and send out your query letter. Unbeknownst to you, like, some of those agents were actually scams. You know, now you've got writer beware or other stuff that it's easy to find out. You know, as I say, one of those mistakes early on, I got an agent. I had one say yes. And oh, I was really excited. And then after a while, they're like, oh, I need some money for these submission fees. And stupid me, I sent a couple $100 and then never heard from that agent again. And so then I was like, oh, okay, got it. All right. I think I get, you know, got to be a little more careful. And then over time, you know, started going to workshops and having professionals like explain how things work. You know, money flows to the writer. You're never paying your agent. So a small error or small mistake I made, but I think it did a lot for teaching me the perils of the industry.
Yeah. And I was thinking the other day, like, because you mentioned writer beware. I hate to see, I see this online in writer groups, and I guess I appreciate seeing it, because then we can catch them when people are like, hey, you know, this publisher says they want to publish my book and they just need this much money from me to do it. You know, it's annoying to see that happening, you know, and I feel like there's got to be some way around them. Like maybe, don't know, like to take their place and catch the writer's attention first to intercept them.
Yeah. And I think that's difficult just with the way the internet works and everything. I think it's just, you know, people have to do their due diligence. I mean, I've definitely talked to a lot of people who mistakenly went that route thinking they were getting something and maybe spent $5,000 or $10,000. And yeah, they got editing, they got a cover, they got a marketing plan. But the that marketing plan was they put it up on their Facebook page that had 50, you know, people on it that are all their relatives working and, you know. But yeah, these scams are elaborate and difficult to detect. I actually had a email the other day from, I think it was like, it said it was Green Dot Productions a movie company, and you know, they were interested and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, I mean, sure. Like, you know, they had spent a little time to make sure that it was personalized, but there was still a lot that felt, you know, templated. And when I went and looked up, I found that production company and they had movies associated. And I was like, okay, maybe this is real. A little more digging, and eventually I found some areas that, yes, there was a Green Dot Productions, but now these people are just using that old website, or maybe they put up like their own version of it. And then they're getting people, once they get you in, then they ask for money for the script work. And that's where, and, you know, and I did find something on Write Everywhere also, I think, within that. So again, that's a good resource if any of your listeners are, you know, aspiring writers, you know, remember, you know, money flows to the writer, and be very, very careful if anybody's asking you for money.
Yeah. And one second, cause I don't have enough light. I had a couple of bulbs die, and I'm looking at myself, and I think my image is really washed out. I can turn one light okay. on. So. Now, this may seem unrelated, but have you seen Facebook ads for Paul the Trombonist, or have you seen ads anywhere for Paul the Trombonist?
No, I have not.
And it's one of those things where you look at it and you're like, is this really legit? And so I kind of bit and looked into that and had a session with one of his cronies, a video chat, no, not video, but had an audio chat with one of his cronies, and they talk about the 7-figure entrepreneurs club, and it's a group coaching program, scale to high profit without sacrificing so much of your time. I'm looking at some of my notes from talking with them. Attract premium buyers / students / clients, convert premium leads. So their angle is, they teach music lessons. Uh-huh. Okay, that's fine. And the more recognized you are as a musician, the higher you can charge for lessons.
Right.
But you know, I'm not a world-class musician, and I was good enough to play my clarinet for the Marine Corps for several years. But like if I were to go out there, and I'd love to go, and that's another option. If not writing, I'd love to make a living just with music again. But he's talking about a model where you have students paying subscription for lessons. That's all legit. That sounds legit. But from my notes, like, how do you get students to pay so much? Is it a year's membership? Because they're talking about like $5,000 sales.
Yeah.
And it's this mastermind thing that they wanted to get us into, that they spend so much on advertising because they're charging so much.
Right.
They can afford to spend much on advertising. So they talk about creating online music education businesses with a premium offering. And most of your students aren't going to be that premium customer, but some are. And then you make that one $5,000 sale a month, you got it made. And it all sounded and felt kind of pyramid scheming.
Right.
Maybe not though. Like I didn't really see a pyramid forming in that, but
yeah. I think it's a lot like the gold rush. The people that made the money were selling picks and shovels and Levi's jeans, not the ones going and get the gold. And I think that there's a little bit of that within publishing, especially the way things have shaken out the last few years with, you know, Amazon kind of turning to a pay to play model and things like that. So you see a lot of people selling Facebook classes or direct sales classes or things like that. And I think there are a lot, you know, some of them that are very legitimate and do absolutely fabulous job teaching real skills for, I think, a reasonable price. And then there are also some of those out there that are selling things for many thousands of dollars, you know, 2, 3, 5, where it's like, okay, this is getting, now I feel like they're selling the themselves and making money rather than actually, you know, because a lot of people, they, you know, kind of, it's back to that vanity, you know, vanity press thing. You know, they're willing to sell it to anybody regardless of where they're at in their career. But, you know, that's a,
I should say, since I mentioned Paul the Trombonist, I actually reached out to, they wanted to sell me a masterclass program for a year, right? So I'm part of this what's the word, cohort or whatever, for a year. And they wanted right around $10,000. And I don't remember the first number they spat out, of course, was so that then they can make the next number sound like a sale.
Yeah, yeah.
The first number that I was 15,000.
Yeah.
Then the second number was less than 10,000, but it might have been 9,500 or 9,800. Right, right. I don't remember exactly. So they threw out the names of some musicians, like, yeah, you know, and he took our program and he loves it, and this musician. I actually looked some of those names up. I didn't tell them that I was writing these names down. I looked them up and messaged them. And they swear by it. Like, where are we? No, that's not. Anyway, so I messaged a couple of them and they said, oh, here's one. So I said, good morning. I sat in a strategy session last week with one of Paul the Trombonist's friends. They said that you did Paul's course. I'm following up and seeing what your take was. What were your thoughts? Was it beneficial? And this person said, and this person, he has a YouTube channel and tons of followers. So it looks legit to me. It says, hi, Don. I am currently in the mastermind and can say you will get out of it what you put into it. If you trust the process, you will succeed. A significant portion of the mastermind and learning is sales. All in all, I have zero regrets about joining. If you stay the course, you will succeed. Hope this helps. So I think it was two people that I messaged and heard back from, and they both said essentially the same thing. So,
and they may have,
but it felt like they were selling me.
Yeah. They may have been planted. They put those names in just to make sure that if you contacted, then you'd get that feedback. But
yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm with you on it. It feels sketchy, especially at that price. At that price, it feels sketchy.
Yeah, and I don't have that kind of money. Like, if there's not any, it doesn't seem sure enough to me to throw that away.
Throw
that kind of money at it.
Right. And I think there's a lot, you know, there's, you know, in any case of any of those, it's like, I think people, before they do that, they should be investigating the free versions of how they accomplish that and doing it themselves before they even think about asking, you know, expert for help, and especially at those prices. But yeah, I think there's always much cheaper versions of the same thing out there, regardless of the industry.
Yeah. So bringing it back to relevance, let's talk about the benefits and challenges of writing a large universe of books. What can you say to that?
So, and you know, I'll address it from both a reader and a writer point of view. I think, like, you know, a lot of fantasy authors, you know, I have a background in gaming, you know, played role play games, stuff like that. I like big worlds. I like big, expansive things where there's lots of nooks and crannies and stuff like that. So, you know, early in my career, I was kind of hopping around in genres, and I realized I really need to just stick to one for a while, because you don't really, it's hard to carry over readers from one, you know, from alternate history to YA dystopia. That the Venn diagram does not overlap there. And so I wanted to do something that I could write for a while in, but I realized there's a problem when you write a single series. One is that you've only, you know, if people don't get in at the beginning, you know, they're not going to want to jump in book 15. And also people can get series fatigue, both the author and the reader. And I think, you know, once the author is bored, then the reader is going to get bored. And I think that happens, like, you know, I think Jim Butcher, I don't know, I think he has like a 23 book plan to finish, you know, his big series, but he's kind of stalled for a while, if I'm correct on that. But my guess, it's a little bit of that just fatigue. He's been writing in that series a long time and he's bored. And so I think going more of the universe route, like Cosmere, that we talked about earlier, where you've got different worlds, different, you know, series that are connected, then it's a lot easier. You know, each of the halls, it provides a different feel, and there's new characters and there's some overlaps between the series, but, you know, I write them to be pulled. Like, if somebody just wants to read one of the halls because they think that was really interesting, and that's it, that's all they ever read there. You know, they read the Animalians because they want to read about, you know, Animal Companion and never read anything else, that's fine. They can do that without ever, you know, feeling like they were missing something from that thing. But for those people that like to read across multiple and see the little connections and things, I think there's a bigger benefit. And that's also is easier than for me as a writer. I, you know, when I get to the end of a series, I don't have to go, you know, it's kind of like when you, a TV show, when they drag out the series longer, like the original writers had, like, well, we're going to do like four or five seasons, and then it does really well and everybody throws more money at them to make it a nine, you know, just like when they were splitting like weird books into two, you know, two movies and stuff like that, like Twilight or The Hobbit. And sometimes you ruin that when you're trying to stretch out. Write the story that you intend to write and end it. You know, I think like one of my favorite series of the recent time is Succession. And they could have drug it out, but they did the best thing and they ended it when they needed to. And that's why I like, you know, each of these series is a 5-book series. I can do a good 5-book series that a reader could enjoy, that I can enjoy writing, and I get to the end of it and I'm done. And now I get to say, okay, what's the new thing? You know, what's the new hall I'm going to play with? How am I going to do it differently? And then, you know, the, one of the kind of benefits I didn't really think about in the beginning, but, you know, you mentioned, my card game that I've developed is having this big world is actually, I've got a lot of material to do other things. And, you know, as a gamer, that is exciting and fun for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had a couple of thoughts. Let me see if I can remember. I like that you made a game, 'cause I've thought about that too. Even though I don't have any books out now, you mentioned, oh, right. So like when a series gets tired and they continue it on and you're like, you know what? This stopped being interesting already.
Yeah.
And it's not because, I don't think it's because the story could not have continued on. I think it's because they're trying to force it on.
Right.
When it either would naturally end, or it naturally end, and they could come up with a good reason for it to continue, but they don't bother to.
Yeah.
They come up with an excuse like, okay, we'll go with that.
Right. Right.
Now, I actually, in a couple of stories that I have in progress, and I say stories, I'm talking about, series that I have in progress or on pause, you know, if it's not actively being written, I have it planned where you're coming to the end of this book, mm-hmm. and you feel like maybe you're going to hit this point of resolution and come closer to the end. But you're going to find out that you're actually not that close. And I think that's, like Harry Potter 6. So spoiler alert, if you haven't read the Harry Potter series, as you come to the end of Harry Potter 6, they go through all that trouble and Dumbledore is severely weakened to the point where he is easily killed. And then the locket that they went through all that trouble to obtain isn't the real locket. It wasn't the Horcrux
right
at all. And it's somewhere else. And so they have to go and go find it somewhere else. So like that didn't, I don't think that upset anyone. It felt kind of like, ah, now I have to get to the next book so I can see what is happening.
Yeah.
Because what I thought was happening isn't.
I think with JK, I mean, it was such a big series. Everybody was, even if that wasn't satisfying for people, they were going on to the seventh because there was just one more book left. But I think she had built up so much goodwill of having good concrete endings. Yeah. I think you could argue that that is the weakest ending of any of those books, but it was still, sad, but satisfying in emotionally ending, even if like, yeah, I agree. Plot wise, it's like, a lot of what, you did in the book didn't come to fruition. But I think it left enough of a hook. I think you can get away with that deep in a series. If she would have done that book one, I think there would have been a much steeper drop off.
Well, I think, yeah, maybe it wasn't the best ending, but it kind of, and the series got dark.
Yeah,
as it went along into the sixth and seventh books, and that's kind of by design because they have to go into the darkness in order to defeat it ultimately. But looking at it from the author's standpoint, she's like, well, this was set out to be a seven book series.
Right.
And I know she had it planned. Excuse me. I know she had things on the large scale planned way ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You know, she didn't come to book six and a half and then decide that at the end of book six, there was going to be this thing that makes you go into book seven. No, it was all set up well in advance, but, if she's building a seven book series, there needs to be something pulling you into that seventh book all along the way. Like each step along the way, Harry has to not defeat Voldemort yet.
Right.
You know? And so in her case, you could argue that it was kind of like she's trying to extend it, but I think it's not like that because her whole design, she's trying to build the design. She's trying to build the good story from beginning to end. And part of that design meant that here at the end of the sixth book, she has to go into the seventh book with something, of a certain design that carries the events in. And I don't have the greatest memory cause I read it years ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see that. It's not like,
her school was set up to be 7 years. So I think the expectation was when she was doing one book a year, it was going to be seven books. And, I think it was logical that it wasn't in school. I think probably there was also a part of that. She was wanting to do a little something different. You know, she had had fun tricks and things that happened throughout like the first five, into 6 years. And then the seventh is kind of them away from the school. And I think that was, there were some cool parts, but there was also a lot of that section away from the school that dragged. Again, it was the last book. We're going to read it regardless, but it dragged because it was away from the school and she didn't have that structure. You know, you didn't have classes or anything's, pulling it along. So it ended up being the three of them being moody teenagers in a tent, with a Horcrux, which, once it got through that and back to the other stuff, I think the pace of that picked up. I think that was what worked so well was that structure she had set up and maybe didn't, in my opinion anyway, again, she, has all the bank account to laugh at my, critique of it, but, again, I thought they were, I loved the books. There was so much that was great about it. You could pick apart any book. You know, we're just talking, you know, writer stuff and how to make things work. I think that section was a little weak, but.
Well, you would be moody too if you were in a tent with a Horcrux.
Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, I have.
You have a Horcrux?
Yeah, I mean, that's an art. No, I don't have a Horcrux. Not that I know of.
Yeah. Clarinet.
No, in my new book, just a moment. Hawthorne, no, bebé, estoy en una llamada. No, enséñame después, amor. Okay? Ahorita no puedo. Okay? I'm glad I locked the door.
Yeah.
in my Nightshade Unicorn book, I actually have, there is some magic that can influence minds. It doesn't control, but it can heavily influence moods.
Right.
And so I have a scene where there's a couple of characters, and they start getting ornery and arguing with each other, because they don't realize that they're under this influence. I shouldn't talk too much about that because it's towards the end of that book, but, And so like moody teenagers in a tent with a Horcrux, I totally get it. Although I guess the argument wouldn't be complaining against the fact of them being moody. It's just the way, what you said, that it kind of dragged.
Yeah. I think logically I get that section, but I think there's the reader experience as well to consider. I think she, you know, maybe if it would have just been shorter or done a little differently, it wouldn't have felt so slow. Again, that was just, you know, my take on it. I thought that section was slow, but.
Okay. Let's come back around to the benefits and challenges of writing a large universe of books. So there's, I think benefits, you get to explore different magic systems. Is that how you would?
Yeah. While the core of how magic works in my world is all, the same, it expresses itself in different ways. So, you know, and I didn't want that, like some magic systems, like if you look at, you know, Mistborn, there are very hard, fast rules of how, you know, the different, different magics work, you know, can bounce off coins and this, you know, all those things. Yeah. But I wanted something a little bit more loose. I mean, I tried to keep at its core in my own mind how things work, but otherwise it was going to be very difficult to explore up to 100 different magical halls without having a very, you know, I think of my magic system as a bit more like physics and chemistry. Physics and chemistry, you know, you can do science, you can understand it, but it expresses itself in different ways. You know, chemistry is like alchemy and physics is like, you know, a lot of the other stuff, and then throwing other things in. Basically, I think when creating a magic system, one, you have to think about the kind of world you want to happen, because the impacts of how magic is used is going to change how the world is. And also from your writer point of view, if you have a very hard, fast magic system, and then down the road, you want like four books in, you want to change it, that's going to alienate some readers who were reading the earlier stuff and said, that's not how that works. So, having a big squishy magic system, is a little bit more advantageous with a large world. And again, I think Sanderson gets away with that by changing things a little bit from, you know, place to place, and how they work. You know, maybe they're learning new things about it or different ways of changing it. And I think that, in a way, makes it work in that way as people would progress.
So with Sanderson, he talks about investiture and or his characters do, and the basis of the Cosmere, if you put yourself in that universe, the basis is that some deity was shattered and the different, I think the different aspects of the deity wound up tied to different worlds.
Right.
So on this world, we have this type of magic. On this world, we have this type of magic. And I can't wait to hear the story of that shattering and the breaking apart of investiture. And I'm guessing he has plans for some final reunification, perhaps. And I don't know. So do you have, like, you have the 100 halls, and it's a magical academy where you have each hall, I guess, to equate it to the Hogwarts cups or the Hogwarts houses.
Yeah.
Each hall has its own brand of magic.
Right, right.
Does it operate like its own academy, or is there unification across? Is there cross pollination between these different types of magic in these different worlds or franchises?
So for you know, like Hogwarts, since that's the magic school everybody knows, they're all teaching the same magic. It's just their houses have a different, like, flavor. You know, Slytherins are, you know, power mad, and Gryffindor is honorable, and Hufflepuff is cotton, you know, that sort of thing. Here, the greater school, basically, if, you know, if you were a very talented mage, you could say, I want to open a hall around this. And if they would grant you that kind of license and connect you to the school, then you could do that. The way magic works in my world is that magic is corrosive to you know, kind of new, fresh brains. If you are using magic without a patron to protect you, then you'll go mad. And so that is why the patron system must exist, and why you have to go basically sign up for a school and get into one of these schools and have them not only teach you the magic, but protect you from the corrosive elements of the magic itself. Because if, you know, magic can do all these powerful things, it's not just going to sit idly in your brain. It's going to start messing with things. So that is how, so they're the each one, and it is totally different. Some are really big schools, you know, the aura healers, you know, they teach healing and they're connected to the hospital and they're, you know, very focused on that, where some of the others actually travel to other realms and do other things in other places. So each one definitely has its own flavor and teaches and treats things in completely different ways.
The patron is able to deflect the taint of Sidene.
Yeah.
If you could. Oh, so actually, Wheel of Time, how would we equate or differentiate? So in the seven Ajahs, they have, because you mentioned you have the aura healers.
Uh-huh.
So in the White Tower, they have the yellow Ajah that focuses on healing. I'm going to mix up some Ajahs. The red Ajah, obviously works on capturing and stilling male channelers. The green Ajah is the battle Ajah. The blue Ajah is focusing on preparing the world for the dragon reborn, but they're all using the same, the same one power. So how would you equate or differentiate between that?
I mean, I think I go back to, you know, my magic system goes back to the history of, like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, where you have different elements that you use to, you know, you've got, you know, gestures and words and material components and things to shape the magic that's coming out of you into a, you know, a result that you desire. You know, I it's been a while since I've read Wheel of Time. I do kind of remember those differentiations, but those are much more hard and fast. And there's also kind of a religion around all that keeps those separate and apart. And that's part of what makes that world interesting, is that very, you know, concrete separation, but, you know, taking it where magic is not, you know, can't necessarily be controlled. So how would you construct a school and, you know, teaching lots of different things? There's, you know, stone singers who are like the civil engineers of mages that sing to manipulate stone into, you know, bridges or statues or whatever they'd like. I mean, you know, there's a million ways you can tackle it, and it's fun to, you know, think about how those might be used.
So I imagine with the, it's the 100 halls. Have you determined what all the 100 halls focus on? I would guess probably not, because that's a lot of magic systems to decide at the outset.
Yeah, yeah. I at the very beginning, I think I wrote down maybe 30 or so, and then over time have added other ones. You know, a hall can go extinct. Let's say, you know, either nobody wants to sign up for it, or, you know, something happens and they blow up their building and, oh, they had, you know, 8 people at this hall and now they're all dead due to somebody's hubris. So it's not an exact number that there's 100 halls, but there are roughly usually around 100 halls at any one time. And like I said, you know, if I find a need for adding a new hall, like, hey, I want to explore this thing, I will add that. Maybe it might add something interesting to the plot.
Like the 100 worlds in the Ender series.
Oh, yeah.
Orson Scott Card.
Yeah.
I don't know if he has named all those 100 worlds, but
I doubt it.
It probably didn't mean exactly 100 literal.
Yeah,
worlds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, the 100-year war wasn't exactly 100 years.
No. So would you say, did you go to any of C.R. Rowanson's sessions? Mm-hmm. Well, you went to the conference. Actually, I know that you went to Rave. Did you go to the conference as well?
Yeah, yeah. I think mostly I was focused on the marketing aspects of indie publishing, you know, direct sales, advertising, things like that. So that's the...
I didn't go to his... Actually, I did go to one, but it wasn't his how to build a magic system. It was a different session. I don't remember what. But I went to last year's conference, and I didn't go to his sessions, but I watched them online, because you can do that after you've been to the conference. And he talks about, I'm forgetting the words he uses. So Brandon Sanderson talks about, hard and soft. And a lot of people talk about hard or soft magic systems. Rowanson says, I actually have his book right here. I leaned over to grab it off the desk over there. Magic System Blueprint. He calls them, it's not logical and illogical. It's, rational and irrational. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
And he has the words hard and soft, but rational and irrational is the difference with Mistborn being very rational.
Right.
You learn about the magic system and how it works from the foundation, and then you could extrapolate something and like, well, if they did this and that, then they could do that.
Yeah.
And probably be right.
Yeah.
Whereas irrational is Harry Potter. You know the Expelliarmus spell, and actually he talks about this example specifically with the Expelliarmus spell. You know that works to knock a wand out of somebody's hand, but would it work if it's a book or a gun or a feather?
Right.
You know that it works this specific way. And you can't really extrapolate and say, well, if they did things this way, then you'd get this effect.
Yeah.
You don't know. Unless you've seen it work this way, you don't know that it will work that way. So how would you say the 100 halls tend to be, more towards rational or irrational?
I would say that if you are clever and work hard enough, you could probably figure out how to do just about anything. So, you know, I almost have an anything goes, but the more ambitious you get, the more more strict the consequences. So I guess you could call that more of an illogical system. There is, while you can almost theorize, just like now you know, science fiction theorizes just about anything from our current, you know, state of understanding of science. You know, in this case, that's how I look at it, is it's almost a scientific view of magic. the way it works in my world. But from just a casual reader, I'm sure it would feel a bit more illogical. I try to have a more of a hard view of it, a logical view and the underpinnings, but comes out and expresses itself more illogically.
Yeah. Well, and Lord of the Rings is totally irrational. There's no trying to figure out the magic system in Lord of the Rings. I'm kind of in between. I feel like with Nightshade Unicorn, like I've decided that these unicorns have these two main powers and these unicorns have these two main powers. But when they cooperate, that might develop more powers. And I haven't honestly decided yet. I need to decide that before I write the last book, obviously. But I think it's a good place to be in to have some irrationality, you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
To have something, to have some curtain still up.
Yeah, 100%.
Because you can do some reveal at the end, but it has to feel like it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know? Have you read Levin Thumps?
No, I have not.
Lesser known. But the first book is really good. Like it pulls you right through. And the main character gets pulled into this world called Foo. And that's not reality. Like there's reality and there's Foo. Mm-hmm. And there are certain ways to travel to Foo. It's usually you can't do it on purpose. And then in Foo, there are certain rules, but the rule is that it's not reality.
Right.
But like there's no murder in Foo. It's impossible to intentionally kill someone. So like the big bad guy will do things that will place people in danger that other people don't know about.
Right.
And then they do some normal thing and it kills the victims because they didn't know that there was a victim they were going to get killed. Like there are people called wisps. They're quasi ghosts. So he freezes them and puts them in balls and gives them to kids to play with and hit bats at. Boom. There. Now he's killing these wisps.
Yeah.
So the first book is, it just pulls you right through. But there are some things later in the series that just kind of feel a little too contrived.
Yeah.
And it's, I get what the author is going for because it's not reality. It's the dreamland.
Right.
It's kind of the possibilities, anything could happen. But when the main character is trapped in a place and he needs to get out, like he finds himself able to hold on to a moonbeam and pull himself out. And that's cool, except that there's absolutely no predictability.
Right, right.
Like there's, when you read it, you're like, there's no way I could have seen that coming at all.
And I think that comes in where you, early on in my writing career, I tended to be too coy with what was going on and thought I was being clever, you know, the surprise reveal, the things like that. Over time, I've realized it's better to over explain and over foreshadow everything because most readers don't ever pick it up. There are a small percentage that will figure out everything. But that's okay. That's part of their enjoyment is reading and figuring all the little details out and guessing the ending. And that's fun for them. And that's cool. Most people aren't going to do that. But if you haven't, you know, if that writer didn't add something earlier on that suggested you could do that, and then you get to the point where the moon beat, and then that pulls you out of a story, you're like, I don't understand. But if, you know, there were three or four clues earlier, then you're like, oh yeah, I remember this thing. I should have caught it. It, you know, it's like the comedian's callback, you know, everybody cheers when they call back to the earlier joke, you know, it's a lot of fun, you know, when you see those things, you know, throughout that.
Like Star Wars. So spoiler alert for episodes 7 through 9,
And that was because they had different writers doing that. And, you know, the whole Palpatine comes back. It was because they didn't have a plan. That's why it didn't make any sense.
And Luke's force projection, like, when did anybody ever do a force projection before? And you pulled out of your rear end in movie 9. Like,
yeah,
this was not part of the Jedi magic, you know, that the Jedi, that's not what part of what they can do. And well, until now,
right?
You don't just pull that out at the end.
Yeah,
you have to foreshadow it somehow.
Yeah,
hint at it somehow.
I think that's, you can do anything if you tell the readers ahead of time, if you give them and put those in there. You know, one of a writer, Megan O'Keefe, her book Velocity Weapon. If you like science fiction, thrillers, like fast paced, it's a brilliant, brilliant novel. And when you read it the first time, there are multiple reveals that just have you like setting the book down and like contemplating and like, wow, what a great twist. And when you read it a second time, you realize she telegraphed all those things in so many ways that make sense afterwards. I think, the best, or one of the greatest, you know, reveal movies is Fight Club. If you rewatch that movie, they're telling you the truth over and over again. It's not one time or five times or 10 times. The whole time, if you know the answer in the end, you know what's going on in the beginning. And it's brilliant how it's done. And I think that's a good lesson is if you're writing a book, if you're writing a story, tell everyone everything. But it's more about, you know, the investment in the characters and all those other things that are going to pull you through. If you're just dancing through some hoops to get to a big surprise, it's going to most likely be disappointing thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I never saw Fight Club, but, I feel like we came around to the question of plotting versus pantsing, or discovery writing. And I do a mix, you know, I feel like I need to know where I'm going,
mm-hmm.
But I don't always know how I'm getting there yet.
Yeah.
But,
So I am sort of a plotter, maybe like 70%, 60% plotting, 40% pantsing. I do like to understand the structure. When I set off on a 5-book series, I know the arc of the story for the 5 books. Excuse me. I know what each book is going to be about, and I know roughly the ending of each book. And then I will construct a rough outline, maybe a page or two about a book before I write it, just so I understand all the pieces. But then, you know, the characters will naturally do different things, or I'll realize that I've gotten to a point where, you know, the original outline isn't working, and I'll rewrite the outline. And so if I get a third of the way through and I realize that's not working, I'll rewrite the outline and then I'll continue on. And that's usually been my method. But I actually, for the book that I'm working on now, I decided to try something different because I was on a flight recently and it was like United or something, and paging through like the free movies you could watch, I found a James Patterson masterclass, and I thought, hey, you know, I've got 3 hours on this flight, I'll watch it. You know, I skipped through some, was, you know, rudimentary. It was meant towards like people who might be newer writers. So there was a lot that I understood, but there were some, when he was talking about outlining and he really went over what he did and why. And I thought, you know what, that's something I want to try because of that. I really want to like write an outline, rewrite it and nail down the story ahead of time and see how that goes. So I, instead of a one and a half page outline, I wrote a 10 page outline. Chapter by, you know, maybe 2 pages of like opening material, just about all the characters, what's going on. And then eight pages of chapter by chapter, you know, a solid paragraph about each one, what it was about, what was going to happen, how it ended, and, you know, which point of view it was from. And, you know, so far I'm a third of the way through my current book and I haven't, but very minorly deviated from that outline because I'm like, oh yeah, this makes a lot of sense. But it's also been very different experience because I, you know, it used to be like a panic. Oh, tomorrow I know what the chapter roughly needs to be, but I don't know anything about it. So then I'd have to like go on a run and like try to figure it out or talk to my wife and we'd brainstorm. So there was always this like forced panic that would get me through it. Well, now I'm like, I'll sit down and except for a few exceptions where maybe something hadn't worked it out as well as they needed to, I sit down, I read the, you know, the chapter, what it's supposed to be. I read the chapter before to make sure it's connected. And then I sit down and start writing. I'm like, wow, this is a different experience. I, at least so far, I think I will continue doing that. I don't know if I'll do it forever, but for this one, it's been a different experience in writing completely. And I think that also is important to freshen things up, you know, 60 books in to, hey, let's try to do it a different way and see what other aspects that helps me explore. You know, you don't want to get complacent to, oh, I know how to write a book. Cause I think actually, you know, that, this summer, I think I went too willy nilly into a book, wrote the full thing and realized I hated it and it wasn't very good. And so I trashed it and started over, you know, from ground zero. So, you know, I think I was looking also just for something to break up the process and see if I could, you know, write in a different way.
I really feel what you said about, being in this panic, like I need to write this chapter tomorrow. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
I definitely had that experience with Nightshade Unicorn. Well, and with the Grendhill Chronicles, because I started web noveling it on my own website before, like as far as I knew, I invented the web novel, you know, in my own, independently. I came up with the idea in like 2014 or 15. And I tried to post like at least like 800 words weekly. And I didn't keep it up. I couldn't keep it up. I was too busy.
Yeah.
But, I'm kind of like, well, what now? But with Nightshade Unicorn, I was on an internship during my last few months on active duty, and that gave me time to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in communication with a very successful independent author, because I'm trying to learn that business and that craft. And he had identified a daily word count goal of 2,000 words per day. And so I came into it, I'm like, I'm not going to work at my unit every day,
right?
Because I'm on this internship. This is my job.
Yeah.
And I better do my job. And so hitting that 2,000 word count goal, well, I interpreted it weekly, you know, so I said 2,000 words per week. Because I wasn't going to write on Sundays. That's my day off, period. And I hoped to not have to write on Saturdays. And if I could keep on my toes on throughout the week, then I wouldn't have to write on Saturdays. I still had to write on Saturday. But I hit a point where I was past the beginning. And like the main character had started her journey and she'd gotten along her way a little bit. And then I'm like, now what?
Yeah.
Because it's too early for the end.
Yeah.
And some things need to be set in place before the end. But I have to write 2,000 words today. And it was really super stressful. And so that first day that I really hit that wall hard, because I had no idea what I was going to write.
Right.
It was so stressful. I wrote a short story instead.
Yeah.
That day. Just to get some words out. And actually I had to get 3,000 words out that day to catch up. So I wrote a short story about some knights talking about slaying dragons. While I also tried to stew and simmer and figure out how the story was going to continue from there. And it was hard. And so right now, like I feel the crunch to write book two because I need to, you know, I need to, if this is my job now, cause it is. And officially as of this Saturday, December 2nd at my full-time job.
Right.
I need to put out a product if I'm going to sell anything and make a living.
Yeah.
So I feel this pressure to put out book two, but I don't have a clear idea in my mind of how book two is proceeding yet.
Right.
And I have started an outline and I've been super busy. So even though I finished book one a month and a half ago, and I feel terrible about not starting book two yet, but I have to back up and understand, like, there are so many administrative things that I've had to take care of while processing out of the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And I need to make sure that, because I have some medical things, and I want to make sure that if that results in any disability rating, that I do my part in making sure that things are properly documented. I go talk to the right people and get all that done. So, like, I've had things to take care of. And then there was 20 books, Vegas.
Yeah.
Also. Not just that, because I'm in Virginia and I drove to 20 books Vegas right. because I needed to see my house in Kansas on the way. It was the house that we bought when I taught school, before I joined the Marine Corps, and it's been rented out to different people along the way. And so whenever I find myself crossing the country, I stop by, driving between here in Vegas, stopping to see my house adds 1 hour of driving.
Right.
So, and it costs pretty similar to flying.
Yeah.
If I drive a small engine car, which I did.
Yeah.
So, but that meant that I had not one travel day on each end of the conference. I had three on each end, and maybe it should have been 4 days. Cause there were long days of driving.
Yeah.
But, and then Thanksgiving, and I have a family, I have kids. And so Thanksgiving takes more of my time.
Yeah.
It should. I smoked a turkey for the first time. Turned out delicious.
Yeah.
It was moist.
Yeah, I think it's tough getting writing output if you don't know where you're going. And I know writers have a love-hate relationship with word count goals. But I think, you know, early on, word count goals are great just to get you to write. I think that, like, you know, the way you said there, I didn't know what I was going to write on this, so I wrote a short story. That to me, that's perfect. I've been in that same spot, you know, where, oh crap, I don't know what I need to do here. So while I'm working on this, I'm going to do some throwaway short story. It may go nowhere. It may just sit in a bin, but at least I'm working and developing and practicing. But when you're trying to, you know, actually get that, you know, positive word count, it's that preparation that gets you that word count. You know, I'm hitting, you know, my goals every day because I know exactly what I need to write. And then it's just a matter of sitting down and doing it. And when people are struggling with that blank page, with not knowing what it is, it's, you know, they haven't developed what that outline is or put that work in to figure that out. And that was always where those kind of panicked, I need to go on a run, was to figure that out. But at least I understood my own process of how I could get that. Hey, if I do these things, I'm, you know, going to be able to the next day, you know, hit that and feel happy about it, because I don't want to just write to write. It's got to be good. It's got to be meaningful to the story.
Yeah. And I appreciate that you said going on a run. So I've had an injury. I've had a bad knee for the past year and I can't run. Yeah. And it's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I've had lots of ideas while out on runs.
Yeah.
Something else you mentioned, as far as, well, kind of we both mentioned, like, what am I writing today? One thing I did early on with Nightshade Unicorn was I wrote the end of book one, and I wasn't in that panic, like, what am I going to write today?
Yeah.
But it was the most obvious thing. I had this thing in my mind.
Like, right.
This is where I'm going. I'll go ahead and write it. I've heard authors suggest, write, like, you can jump out of the sequence of a book and write a scene that's going to happen in the future. And I'm really glad I did in this case, because the whole time I had a clear idea of where I was going.
Yeah.
And,
There are a lot of people that are out of order riders.
Well, I was still farther away. It was kind of scary.
Yeah.
But as I got closer to it, it was like, booking along.
I tend to use there's always, I've heard people describe them like as their dessert chapters. Like they're the chapters they're most excited about writing. And they typically happen towards the end because you've been like working through all this to get to that. Some people like to just write their dessert chapter early on and then they want to build up to it. Some people like to eat dessert before they eat their meal. So, however it works, I tend to use that as like a, ooh, I can't wait to do that, but I need to get through these other ones. I need to, eat my meat and potatoes and, my filet with a gorgonzola port wine sauce and enjoy that before I get to the cheesecake at the end, kind of thing. I use those chapters as a reward, but I think it makes also a lot of sense to write the ending because then you know exactly where you're going throughout that.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we're kind of wrapping up, and looking at the length of recording, we're at an hour and 15 minutes right now. I think I'll split this into two episodes. Okay. I have you slated for this, I guess the first of these two episodes, to go out on December 21st. December is pretty full already. So I'll push the second part the first part is going to be longer than the second part. The second part is, I'm going to split it where we really started talking about craft.
Yeah.
And different techniques and methods. I'll probably push that to January 11th. Because January 4th will be the first episode of the year, and I'll do a special season 3 opener. Because I'm calling this season 2, even though I started in 2020. This is my first consistent year publishing the podcast. So I'm going to slate this in right now, just so I don't forget it. And we're still on the recording. And we haven't finished yet. Almost there.
Listeners get to hear the nuts and bolts of podcasting.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now I am slating in. So part 2, we will publish on January 11th. And December is already full enough that I'm already going to publish on two Mondays. Because I mined the conference for for podcast guests, and I filled my December, and I have a few more lined up as well. So now we have to know, I want to ask where listeners can find you on the web, where they can buy your books, but can you first tell us about your current series specifically?
The current series that is coming out, not necessarily that I'm writing, I haven't talked about that, but the first series of season 2 of The Hundred Halls, kind of like you split it up. The first 6 series was season 1, and then time passed and we starting season 2, is called The Crystal Halls. The first book is Shadows and Amber. It is about the criminal underworld of the Hundred Halls. So, there are ways to condense magic into tiny gemstones that give people supernatural powers. And these criminals who have kind of martial arts background use this to suddenly develop these big powers that they can now compete against the mages and other things like that. So it's really about this criminal network and the people involved with it. It's a little bit different look. It's not specifically the school, but it's also its own school on it. The first 2 books are out, Shadows and Amber and The Emerald Eclipse. And the third book, The Sapphire Stratagem, is coming out in a couple of weeks. This is a 5-book series. It is a lot of fun. My beta readers loved it. The people who have read the first two love it. And if you like magic and fun Magical Academy action books, this is definitely the kind of books for you. And as far as where you can find me, my website, thomaskcarpenter.com, and I am on all of the online retailers, as well as I have my own store, which you can find on my shop, where I release books cheaper and earlier than anywhere else.
Okay. So they can go to Thomas K. Carpenter and buy directly from that website?
Yes, yes. And it's not only cheaper for you, but it gives me a higher profit than what I would get on Amazon or anywhere else. So, and I think that's definitely a direction that a lot of authors are going for various reasons. But it really appreciate it. If an author has a website with a shop on it, that is definitely the place to get it.
Okay. I'm going to extend this a little bit more if you have time and can answer another question.
Sure, yeah.
We're going to deviate from, because this is my podcast and we can do this. We're going to deviate away from reading and writing and talk shop business.
Okay.
Because you mentioned, and I want to do this too, and I'm not selling any books yet as of now. I don't remember if I mentioned already during this interview, but my first book I'm aiming for a release on February 28th, 2024.
Nice.
How do you manage? Because you mentioned you sell earlier and cheaper on your website. How does that work with like being on Amazon? Because I'm new to this. I haven't done this yet.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that Amazon, there's some kind of price control within Amazon.
Right, right. So, yeah, Amazon does have price matching. However, they're only looking at the other big retailers. They're not looking at individual author websites or anything like that. There's, I think it'd be, yeah, I'm sure somebody could figure out how to do it, but they're not really concerned about that, at least right now. Maybe in the future, when all their authors have moved off to have their own Shopify or WooCommerce stores, they realize that they ruined their golden goose. So for right now, they do not do price matching now.
Do you run anything through Kindle Unlimited?
No, I did for a couple of years, but it came to the conclusion that it was becoming pay to play. You know, back when Amazon first launched their advertising, they made like $1 billion that first year. I think now they're making somewhere like $35 billion. And that's coming mostly from the people who are selling products, because to be at the top of the list, you have to spend money on Amazon advertising to get there. Therefore, you're giving most of your profits back. It used to be in the early days that the algorithm was based on what is popular, what do people like, what are people enjoying. So it was a more merit-based system. If you're familiar with the TV show Silo, which the original book was Wool by Hugh Howey, he put that novella up not even realizing what he had, and it took off because people blew through it and recommended it to their friends, and the algorithm took off, and he realized, wow, I've got a real thing here. So then he wrote the rest of the novellas, which eventually came together in that Wool omnibus, or I guess Silo omnibus when they rebranded it with the show. That would never happen now, because he would have put that up. You know, if he put that up in 2023, it goes up on there, he doesn't spend any money on it, and it dies in an early grave and never goes anywhere, despite being a brilliant novella and an eventual whole series of novellas that turned into the show. So, and I think that's the disappointing thing, is it's become such a business that you don't see you lose a lot of great books in there.
So with because Kindle Unlimited has to be exclusive. If you're in Kindle Unlimited, now to be precise, and I have not looked carefully at those terms, because I have not been at the point of publishing a book Now you can have some intellectual properties, IPs. You can have some IPs in Kindle Unlimited and some elsewhere. Is that correct?
You can do paperbacks wide. That when they're talking Kindle Unlimited, it is just in eBooks. And if you have your books in Kindle Unlimited, you cannot even sell them on your own website. That is part of the agreement. Will they find out? I don't know, but you know, I like to follow the legal rules and not, you know, try to be shady.
Because there's the possibility they could find out.
And you know, I'd like to keep my Amazon account. I want it to be less of my overall sales, which it's slowly getting that way as I'm moving to the direct sales and other things, Kickstarter, stuff like that. Basically, two years ago, I realized the Kindle Unlimited wasn't working and had to go wide. And then I saw direct as an opportunity and started doing that. And right now I'm seeing it as a big future. I mean, I think you'll probably have the, 7-figure authors, which was at the beginning of the 20 books. I thought the most important question that was asked of them was, what are you looking to learn and what are you going to be doing as you go into 24? Every one of them said direct sales. And I thought that was important that they said that, because in the back of that conference area, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Kobo, Google Play, we're all back there. And mostly it's Amazon that need to hear that, but that everybody is looking to go away from their platform because of how they have treated authors.
But Amazon was there, but were the people in the room listening to that?
Well, I think they had like 10, 12 people there. So if they're bringing that many people there,
I think they had 27.
Huh?
I think Craig Martell said in the Facebook group ahead of time that there were going to be 27.
Okay.
Amazon
and that's right. Cause they also had like, they were having private parties for their all-stars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they probably had more people there for that, but yeah, at that booth was any, you know, there were that many people.
Oh,
and
yeah,
hopefully they took that back of saying, hey, authors aren't happy and they're moving away from us. What can we do to, you know, competition is important. If you look at, Ingram, which is, you know, everybody for the longest time used them for hardbacks, but they had terrible customer service. If you get books out of their Tennessee plant, they're often, you know, have mistakes or damaged. And then they were charging people fees for uploading a new book. Well, once Lulu and Book Vaults, and, you know, some others have come around, well, magically they eliminated their fees and they said they've been working on some of those customer things. So I think that competition is good. We need that to keep it a fair marketplace for authors.
Uh-huh. And I'm sorry, I'm going to make notes. You mentioned Book Vault and Lulu,
yeah. And they, you know, we have our Shopify store hooked up with Lulu. We could have also done Book Vault. It just ended up that Lulu worked out better for us. But I think Book Vault also has that available. You can tie it into your Shopify store and you know, sell paperbacks directly to customers without having to go through. Obviously eBooks are much simpler. Digital products are a lot easier to do.
Yeah. Well, and I'm making notes to myself because I listened to Joanna Penn's podcast this week, and she said that she uses KDP Print for Amazon, Ingram Spark for bookstores, libraries, universities, and Book Vault for her Shopify stores and Kickstarters.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. She's using both Ingram Spark and Book Vault.
Yeah. And we're using still, we have them all, our hardbacks on Ingram as well. And some of the paperbacks, and you know, that's how we get books into libraries as well. You know, I don't even have a specific outreach to libraries, but libraries will find them on there. They'll see the cover and blurb and say, yeah, we'd like to have some of those.
Going back to Kindle Unlimited. Did you say that it's exclusivity only for eBooks, or it's exclusivity and it's only eBooks? Like, Did you say you can do print also at the same time?
So the Kindle Unlimited is just talking about eBooks. So you can have a wide strategy for your paperbacks. You could do a Kickstarter for a paperback as long as you don't offer the eBook of that book you're doing. That will not violate your KDP Select. Again, my knowledge is 2 years old. Once I got out of KDP Select, I stopped worrying about that, but I believe that is still the way it works. So they're just talking their digital product because they're trying to push people into that exclusivity, for their Kindle Unlimited program. And that's where people.
And just then my home internet service died and it was down for a while. So we didn't really finish that conversation. We talked a little on the phone, but unfortunately that didn't get recorded. Yeah, it was really awkward and really uncomfortable to realize, like, you know, and I'm the one supposed to be hosting this podcast and suddenly I'm gone. And yeah. So thanks to Thomas K. Carpenter for the interview. Make sure you go and check out his site on the web at thomaskcarpenter.com and check out his books, check out his games, and have a great day. We recorded that on November 29th. It is now December 19th, and you're going to hear this on December 20th if you keep yourself up to date. Otherwise, whatever. Anyway.
While I'm talking, we did mention it earlier. I not only have a series of books, but I have a cooperative card game based on the 100 Halls that's coming out on Kickstarter in February. It's called Champions of the 100 Halls. You can find links on my website, or if you go to Kickstarter, search Champions of the 100 Halls, or you can go to Board Game Geek and search it there, and you can find the links from there. It is a game for 1 to 4 players. We're cooperating to beat scenarios based on the books. If you like games like Magic the Gathering, but want a more group-friendly cooperative version, it's a great game. And I think I will, since Don doesn't appear to be coming back, I will say goodbye and thanks for listening to us. Oh, wait, did we get him back? Maybe. Okay. We lose some internet there. You're cutting out there. Well, anyway, it sounds like we've lost him again. So I'll say goodbye.
I'll mention it again, but I'm prepping a Kickstarter to launch on January 1st, and there'll be a special edition for Nightshade Unicorn Forerunner, and the Kickstarter will close January 31st, and the book's public launch will be on February 28th. So check back again, and we'll see you there, when we'll see you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.